Events have been coming back, and that's the good news for Eventbrite, which is a ticketing and content platform. The company last week reported its second quarter numbers, paid ticket volume 16 million, which was up in the triple digits. Net revenue also up in the triple digits, not surprising considering where we were a year ago. Julia Hartz is with us now, Eventbrite CEO and co-founder. Julia, the trajectory has been good. You know, we all saw the pictures of things like Lollapalooza with everybody packed in there. Sure feels like we're not going to see as many packed in there events in the next couple of months. Jazz Fest being canceled once again, pushed off. We'll see if there are other events where that's happening. So how are you guys managing through what now looks like another potential transition period?
Well, thanks for having me. It certainly was a booming quarter in Q2. We're really proud of our results. And I think setting the stage for what's to come, it's important to recognize that Eventbrite is a platform that is serving small to medium-sized businesses who are hosting events that on average are less than 50 attendees. They're about $40 tickets on average for events that are happening in the next 2 weeks. So it's the local book reading at your bookshop. It's the yoga workshop with friends. And these events are the fabric of our social gathering, right? And it's something that humans need to, in order to thrive, is to connect. So we saw a record 1.5 million events happen on the platform. 85% of them were in person. This is just in Q2. And we saw a quarter of a million event creators come to the platform to host those events. So going forward, I see a future that I'm very bullish about because we've realized the importance of what it means to be together, and we're ready to take the necessary safety protocols to be able to gather locally in these unique and intimate settings.
Julia, can you give us a little more insight into the breakdown on sizes of events? Because while the majority of your events may be these small ones, where does the revenue, how does the revenue break down between 50 and under person events and 50 and over person events?
Well, the beauty of the Eventbrite model is that we succeed when our creators succeed. So you have a quarter of a million creators, 88,000 of them are new to the platform in the quarter alone, hosting 1.5 million events and processing 80 million tickets. So if you think about the Eventbrite model, it's very much about the long tail of events. We've captured that market quite beautifully and will continue to grow with our creators. The second thing that I would point out is that frequency has been a huge shift during COVID. We're seeing more and more creators come to the platform to host multiple events a month and sometimes weekly. So for the same creator, we're seeing much more activity, and our revenue model is tied to their ability to sell tickets, and they're selling more and more tickets. In fact, we saw almost the same amount of events in 2020 happen on the platform as we did in the previous year because of the great rise in online events, which is a huge shift that our customers made in the midst of the first wave of COVID. And that's something that we continue to see as a strong trend.
You know, Julia, something I know you guys were asked about a little bit on the call is for those larger events, how you're thinking about the ability to integrate, you know, vaccine passports or those sorts of things that are being more widely discussed. And we've seen it just in the last couple of days, a couple of prominent musicians saying they'll only, you know, perform at venues that have fully vaccinated, you know, policies, with fully vaccinated crowds and so on. How you're thinking about integrating some of those into your platform?
Well, with the majority of our events being these smaller gatherings, I think that there are these tools in every event creator's toolkit that they can hearken back to. When you relate that to a larger event, of course, it's at scale, but it's the same tools. Let's talk about those because we didn't have those a year ago. We have vaccines, certainly. That's been the topic of the day. We have rapid testing. We have masks. And we have social distancing. Those are four really critical tools that allow us to gather socially, safely during this next period of time. And my belief is that people don't want to go back to being locked down. They want to be together. And so they're going to be able to adopt these safety protocols more easily because we know what the stakes are. You know, the other side of this is not a pretty picture. And so what I'm seeing is a big push towards normalcy and connectedness using the tools that we have. And, you know, as this evolves, we'll have more and more tools to keep us safe.
Well, again, sort of to put a fine point on this, Julia. So via your platform, can someone upload an image of their vaccination card or update their vaccination status when they're registering for an event, if the event organizer wants them to do so. Do you have those kinds of options?
Certainly, we have many options for creators to connect with their consumers, their event goers. And we also offer an automated waiver option that they can use with language that, you know, allows them to explain what the safety protocols are for the event. We hope to be integrating with a vaccine verification platform. We're sort of waiting to see what the field presents. There are many different options right now. And as you know, there are many different regulations by you know, each city, each state, each county. And so Eventbrite, as a more, you know, I would say standard option comes to fruit, we will absolutely integrate with that option. That's sort of the beauty of the platform, is that we have API services that can integrate with any external service that helps our creators be successful.
Okay. Julia Hartz, thanks so much. Eventbrite CEO and co-founder. Thanks, Julia. Appreciate it.
A lot to be worked through when it comes to the crypto push here in the infrastructure bill. A dramatic close to the push there. Bipartisan support around the crypto amendment that was sought to be included in that bill yesterday failed to get passed the unanimous consent hurdle there in the Senate after Alabama Senator Richard Shelby objected to get his $50 billion defense spending amendment also included, weirdly, to that crypto amendment, to which Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders objected, and then it all fell apart from there. An impassioned Senator Pat Toomey, who led the charge in reaching a compromise amendment to clarify which crypto companies would have to comply with the improved tax push here, expressed his dismay on the Senate floor that the infrastructure bill would be moving forward without resolving that problem, which he says will kneecap the crypto industry. Take a listen.
We're going to ask these people to provide information that they don't have and they can't get. In what universe does that make any sense at all? All I want to do is have a vote on an amendment that fixes this in a way that has bipartisan agreement, in a way that constrains this to apply narrowly to the people who actually are the intermediaries running a centralized exchange who have this information.
That amendment, of course, won support from not just the Treasury, but also from the White House. So interesting to see where things go from here as the infrastructure bill moves forward. And for more on that, I want to bring on Jeremy Allaire, the co-founder and CEO of crypto company Circle, which, of course, is the company behind the $28 billion stablecoin USDC. And Jeremy, appreciate you coming on here to chat about this, because it was kind of a complicated back and forth. It took a week or so to get both sides around the amendment on the same page. Then you had the White House and the Treasury. I mean, now that this doesn't go through, how is it going to impact the crypto sector and what you guys are working on?
Thanks, Zach, for having me on and happy to talk about the issues. I mean, I think you got to break it down into a few key pieces. I think first and foremost, the original amendment was put forward by Senator Portman, and Senator Portman made very clear, as these revisions and bipartisan consensus was going back and forth, that the intention of this was very clearly to be focused on, exactly as Senator Toomey was saying, on those operators who have this trading information, brokerage-style firms that are involved in supporting end users and institutions who are trading and having 1099s filed, similar to a brokerage account you have with Ameritrade or say some other service. So I think the intention is clear. What's remarkable about what unfolded is, in a very, very fast period of time, the period of about a week or even shorter, there was an incredible amount of effort from many, many stakeholders, not just in the crypto industry, but broadly on Capitol Hill, to really understand the issue here. And, you know, not picking winners and losers in certain technology, understanding more clearly the difference between an open source software developer, or even just a software and hardware creator, and a financial intermediary. And that ultimately landed with, as you said, Treasury, White House, and bipartisan Senate consensus. And really through, what I think is just an unfortunate component of how these bills, these omnibus kind of bills, get through procedurally, you had this sort of blocking right that existed around unanimous consent. So where does this go? I think what's important is that the Treasury, the White House, Capitol Hill, bipartisan support, understand what's at stake here, and they're in agreement about it. And so I have some hope that as this gets to the House, that this issue can be raised there and an amendment can come in before this is ultimately passed into law.
What shape do you think that amendment should take? I mean, it sounds like this is going to pass the Senate, but to your point, it doesn't become law without the House. And so as you try to, if you're looking to appeal to lawmakers, what do you think needs to be fleshed out more in this debate?
Well, what's interesting is that I actually don't think that there's a debate anymore. You had Senator Shelby, who's interested in his defense appropriations, exercising a blocking right, and another Senator Sanders, who's objecting to this incremental defense expenditures. It has nothing to do with crypto, of course. The bipartisan consensus that emerged and the definitions, I think, are relatively sound. And so if those are picked up and attached to what is ultimately passed by the House, then I think we've made significant progress.
Yeah, and Jeremy, I mean, I guess, you know, that's kind of what happens when you come with the unanimous consent push. You know, that's generally those are the risks, right? And some people might say that, you know, you could have been here ahead of it, but there was kind of a last minute inclusion in the infrastructure bill. When you talk about other things, though, and just kind of regulation writ large, you guys made some news there by, opening the push to become a fully chartered national commercial crypto bank. We've seen other entities pursue that route, too. I mean, when you look at maybe where the regulatory pressure is right now, why do you want to go that route? And what does it look like maybe in the potential hurdles to get there?
Well, I think it's a great question. What we've seen happen over the past number of years, and in particular, really since early 2020, is this dramatic growth in the adoption of cryptocurrencies, crypto infrastructure, digital currencies more broadly. This has become a major topic. And dollar digital currencies like USDC, which were the principal operator behind, have grown, you know, at a very, very fast pace, as you noted, now at 28 billion in circulation. That's up from 400 million at the start of last year. And so as this takes place, it's becoming very clear that this is going to be an important part of the banking and payment system. And I think at a global level and now at a national level, the government understands that this is going to potentially touch everyone in the country and actually play a role in how the dollar transacts on the internet around the world. And so with that backdrop, it's actually vital that the United States has a national framework to supervise these large-scale technologies. I think it's appropriate. And, you know, our view is that as we get to this larger scale, we want to be operating under the supervisory framework of the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Treasury Department, you know, the FDIC, and really set a very, very high bar for safety and soundness and risk management in operating global scale digital currencies like USDC.
Yeah, Jeremy, just real quick too on you know how you compare to Tether. Obviously, it's a sliding scale of risks. You guys have your attestations; they have theirs. What do you think sets you apart from them? Kind of looking through the holdings, it looks like you guys are generally kind of similarly split among cash equivalents and, you know, the like. What do you see as the difference there and the sliding scale between, you know, why you wouldn't just be fully in cash and why you have some other assets backing it?
I think the really critical piece here, and I don't focus on any one project or competitor, you know, USDC was designed with the ultimate goal of being a general purpose protocol for dollars on the internet and enabling broad-based payment transactions, everything from buying a cup of coffee or making a micropayment for a piece of digital intellectual property to being used as collateral in the issuing of some form of bond on the internet. So it has very, very broad designs. And that's why we see companies like Visa and MasterCard and others supporting it as a standard. This is not just about crypto trading on offshore exchanges. This is about building an infrastructure for payments, commerce, and financial applications on the internet. And from day one, doing that in a regulated environment. And I think that's been really key. This is operated under state banking supervisory regimes under money transmission law. That's a very high bar on many fronts, on consumer protection, on anti-money laundering management. And so operating it in the United States in the regulated U.S. banking system has really been a key differentiator and the reason why USDC has taken so much market share over the past 18 months.
Circle co-founder and CEO Jeremy Allaire, it's good to talk to you today. I hope to have you back on the show again soon. Well, colleges across the country will resume in-person classes full-time later this month, but Arizona State University is doubling down on virtual learning through a new partnership backed by Steven Spielberg, with students immersing themselves through a VR experience. For more on that, let's bring in Dr. Michael Crow. He's the president of Arizona State University, and he's joining us from the ASU GSV conference over in San Diego. Dr. Crow, it's always good to talk to you. I'm going to get to the specifics of this real exciting launch in just a bit, but you are a few weeks out from classes starting. You've got an interesting situation in Arizona where you've got the governor saying you can't mandate vaccines and masks. And as a university president, you're trying to sort of balance both sides between safety and coming in compliance with what's mandated statewide. How are you dealing with all that?
Well, it's complicated. Kiko, nice to see you. I mean, it's very complicated. So what we're relying on is common sense. So we have a thing called the ASU Community of Care. People are signing up. People are getting vaccinated. We've got masking highly recommended. We're going to do masking in certain spaces where people can't socially distance. So we're going to be using every tool that we've got. We've got most of our people vaccinated, many more getting vaccinated. And so we're going to move ahead and make this work.
What percentage of students are vaccinated right now? I wonder if you have a number on that. And then just how frequently you're going to be testing. What kind of protocols do you have in place, just given that things have definitely improved from a year ago, but there's a lot of concerns around the surge in the Delta variant?
Well, so the vast majority of our students are vaccinated and we're offering vaccinations along the way. They're going to be reassembling. They're coming in from all over the world, over 100 countries, all 50 states. And so we've got a number of things moving forward. We've got random testing that we're going to be putting in place that will be out there. We've got ubiquitous testing. You just drop off your saliva sample anywhere on campus. It gets tested right away. We've got vaccinations everywhere. And so what we're offering is the pathway for people to make the right decisions, the right choices, and to move forward. And we think that we'll be able to do that.
Yeah, and when we talk about, trying to push students to kind of be healthy, be safe, come back on campus, everyone's excited to get back on campus and do this right. Are there other incentives out there that ASU might be providing?
Well, there's the incentive of you're a part of a community and here's how the community will be successful. There's an incentive that, we want everything to stay together and keep moving forward and so forth. And so the incentive is reminding everyone of the fact that they're a part of this community. Now, there's certainly incentives related to the fact of, we want to push you to get your vaccine. We're making it available, in a significant way. There may be some party favors, things like that. But basically, the incentive is learn to be a part of a community, learn to care about someone other than just yourself. And we really push that. I mean, that's the incentive. The incentive is to learn to be a part of a community and then see what happens on the positive side.
Dr. Crow, we've talked so much throughout the pandemic about just how the way we learn has shifted as a result of everybody being stuck at home. Certainly Zoom classes really prevalent last year, but you've got an announcement today where you're doubling down on that digital experience with a partnership through this company that's backed by Steven Spielberg. Learning in VR, and why go in that direction when it feels like universities are increasingly going back to in-person classes? What do you see in that investment?
Well, this project with the company called Dreamscape Immersive, in the joint effort that we have now called Dreamscape Learn between the two of us, is not only about responding to the pandemic and so forth and so on. What it's really about at its heart, and our work accelerated during the pandemic, what it's really about at its heart is finding a way to eliminate this barrier to mastery of science, technology, engineering, and math subjects as a place to start. So we've built a tool which enables a kind of learning, what we call learning through exploration or education through exploration. We found a way to excite the brain in certain ways where every student becomes, the central scientist, the central actor in a completely immersed avatar-driven learning environment. And what we find in our early findings of having built all the things that you see on the screen with our partner, Dreamscape Immersive, is that we have greatly enhanced outcomes in our first course that we're developing, which is a multi-course curriculum in biology around an experience where you travel up to an alien zoo, and the alien zoo is your laboratory of species from all over the galaxy, and this becomes your learning environment. What we found is, you know, massive enhancements in the ability of, I guess what you'd say is, people who don't get science naturally, which is the vast majority of the population, with greatly enhanced learning outcomes. And so the pandemic drove us to accelerate our investments in these areas and to develop this partnership. That then has allowed us to produce this technology platform. The platform will be used on campus, it will be used online, it will be used in high schools, it will be used in colleges, and it will go beyond biology. But moving forward, this, what we've learned so far in biology is like, you know, the virtual equivalent of an earthquake in the learning space. We finally found a way to get everybody to learn science.
You can count me as somebody who doesn't get science naturally. You just reminded me of how poorly I did in the subject.
And it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be the case. So.
And you're talking about applying this for this biology course, but from a university standpoint, does this replace the lectures and the classes and the work we're sort of accustomed to doing traditionally, or does it run complementary to that? How do you see the application beyond this particular course?
So everything is complementary. So in what we find in certain courses is that we need to enhance the learning environment to empower the individual way in which humans learn. We need to enhance the ability of the professor to reach across a broader spectrum of students, which we have a very broad spectrum of students. And so this is an enhancement, not a replacement. The faculty that have been involved in this are master teachers, you know, masters of the universe teachers who are involved in developing these tools to greatly enhance the tools they have available to them now. And so what we're looking for here is everybody becoming science literate using these kinds of technologies, everybody finding a way to enjoy things related to learning science and technology. And then beyond that, expanding into the humanities and the social sciences and others using these additional tools. And so we're very excited about that.
Yeah, it is fascinating to see how things have shifted on the education front. But Dr. Michael Crow, always good to have you on the show, president of Arizona State University. Well, the uptick in COVID cases in children has reignited the debate over vaccine mandates for teachers as more and more students head back to school. California is yet to mandate the vaccine for public school teachers. For more on that, we are joined by seventh grade math teacher Juana Rodarte, and she is joining us as part of our week-long series, The State of Education as Americans Get Ready to Head Back to School. And we've got our very own Reggie Wade joining in on the conversation as well. Juana, it's good to talk to you today. Walk me through the specifics of your school right now, how you're thinking about your safety as well as the safety of students without the proper mandates in place.
Well, good morning. And first of all, the first thing I did when the vaccine was available to teachers, when I got my letter, it was a priority because I don't want to be bringing home to my family and friends, you know, something, knowing that I could have prevented that. Students, well, not all of them are going to be vaccinated. And that's going to be tough, because we're going to be wearing masks inside the classroom, on the buses, but nutrition and lunch, they're not going to be required to wear their mask. And so not all of them are vaccinated. And, you know, it's a choice. And I really do hope that every student that can get vaccinated does get vaccinated.
Juana, Reggie Wade here. Do you believe that the mitigation strategies that have been taken by your school district will keep school open throughout the year?
That's a tough one, really tough one. I mean, they're doing their best, but I gotta tell you, I work at a school where our air conditioning system, every year when we return back from summer, it's not functioning. I mean, I've been at open back to school night and I'm drenched in sweat and parents are in there sweating with me. I'm introducing them to the classroom. And just this week, I mean, I've been there and the AC's not working. And I'm like, wow, we have no windows, one door, and we're all going to be wearing masks indoors. This is going to be very interesting. We're going to try. We're really going to try. But wow, I don't know. I don't know how it's going to go.
What are you hearing from the parents of students? Are they confident in the measures the school has taken?
They're asking a lot of hard questions, I hear. of our administrators, and they definitely want their students back in the classroom because there has been a learning loss. But there is also that concern, right, that maybe I chose my child not to be vaccinated, maybe my child doesn't qualify for the vaccine, and they're going to bring it home, you know? And so I know our school, our administrators are getting tough questions, and it's hard. It's day by day. I mean, it's just day by day. Even when we're online, it was day by day too, because you didn't know if I was the one that was going to get sick and I had to call in and ask for help or somebody take over classroom or whatnot. So it's going to be very tough. And honestly, it's just a day-to-day business right now.
Yeah, and one, obviously, it's day-to-day business, but you guys are kind of under the gun here in terms of the pressure of getting back in and doing this well. I mean, when we talked to a superintendent in Iowa yesterday, he was talking about not knowing if there were going to be enough substitutes to kind of make up for the teachers that weren't going to be coming back this year. I mean, when you look at staffing there at your school and kind of stress levels from teachers as well, I mean, how do you assess the situation when it comes to those resources?
Wow, it's going to be so tough because it's, I think, countrywide that the lack of substitutes, teachers leaving, not choosing to go back because we have to go back into the physical classroom. And, you know, they might have immune problems that they just don't want to expose themselves to. I mean, just my colleague yesterday told me that she might not start the week. And I'm like, wow, is there going to be a substitute for the first week in your physical classroom? And I know our administrators at our school have been so supportive. They will step up and they will handle the classroom, you know, but who's going to be teaching the children, right? Who's going to provide whatever education they need right now that we can give them? So that's going to be tough. I mean, honestly, I try never to be absent just because I want to have consistency and provide to my students as much as I can while I have them physically in the classroom. But this year is different. It's, you know, we're sick, I'm sick, they get sick. I mean, the learning loss, I feel it's going to continue. It's going to continue. It started before COVID. Yeah. It got worse during COVID, and it's a live to learn here.
Juana, on the education front, how are you looking at this knowledge gap that we have seen open up over the last year? I mean, we've heard plenty of struggles of parents, you know, getting their kids to sort of focus in online learning. Those teachers saying they've had some students who've gone missing, some because they didn't have the connectivity in place. I mean, this opens up a whole nother discussion about how you structure your classes when the learning experience has been so uneven over the last year.
So definitely, for sure, all that happened to me last year. It is important to be in a physical classroom because I can ensure that my students, while they're there, they're learning, they're thinking, they're processing, because I'm making sure of that. You know, and online, just the computer alone is a distraction for them. Sure, they could connect to Zoom, but at the same time, they're watching their videos, gaming, or they have the computer screen off. You know, I can't see them. The video's not running. I don't know if they're asleep, if they're working or not. But when they're physically in my classroom, that's already hands up. Okay, we're here to go. Let's do some learning. We're going to get into the math. We're going to have discussions. We're going to think. We're going to process. We're going to work. And I could see that productivity happening in my classroom. Whereas online, wow, that was a whole different story.
What's one thing that makes you hopeful as we come into this new school year that might look a lot like the last, unfortunately?
So I'm glad we're going to be back in the classroom. Definitely glad about that. I'm not happy that our AC at our campus is not running. So we're going to be hot and stuffy in there for I don't know how long. I am very happy that I'm going to physically see my students and get to engage with them and see, even if mask up, you know, and if I go out to nutrition and lunch, which I usually do, I'll be able to see them like full face and see them, the way they interact with each other, their smiles, their laughs, their goofiness, all that was missing from the regular classroom. And it's what makes teaching enjoyable when children are there participating and engaging with you and you have that human aspect of it. So I look forward to all of that. How long is it going to last? I don't know, right? We have this outbreak happening and I don't know. I don't know how long it's going to last. All I know, I'm going to start the classroom physically, yeah. But I'm also starting an online classroom. I'm going to continue with that in case I need to fall back with that.
Well, why don't we wish you the best of luck as you begin the new school year. I know it's been a challenging last 18 months or so. Juana Rodarte, she's the seventh grade math teacher at La Merced Intermediate in Montebello, California. And our thanks to Reguate as well for joining in.
Let's talk now about the photography and photo sharing company Shutterfly. They've acquired the digital printing company Spoonflower for $225 million. Now, Spoonflower helps users create custom fabrics, wallpaper, and more. Here to chat about the deal is Shutterfly CEO Hillary Schneider. So, Hillary, this really seems like a lot of natural synergy, at least between Shutterfly and Spoonflower. So what can some of the Shutterfly users now expect with this acquisition?
Yeah, one of the things that we're so excited about with this acquisition is the fact that it essentially democratizes the ability for everybody to be a creator. And historically on Shutterfly, that creation was photo personalization. But with Spoonflower, it really broadens the marketplace to enable personalization to include custom design. And so there's millions of designs that you can get on Spoonflower for fabrics and wallpapers and table linens and bed linens that really allow you to authentically express yourself. And so you'll be able to buy those goods on Shutterfly and Snapfish. Likewise, we'll be introducing our 21 million customers to Spoonflower and its amazing product set.
Now, you talk about the exploding DIY or do-it-yourself movement over the course of the pandemic, the last 18 months or so. Do you see that demand staying as we kind of head out of the pandemic now? So many companies have talked about the growth that they saw over the pandemic, but even just in their recent quarterly earnings, have talked about some of that demand leveling off. And frankly, we've heard about some of that demand really being unsustainable.
Yeah, I think that I'd like to talk about two trends. One is over the last decade, we've certainly seen a trend toward e-commerce away from bricks and mortar. And I think with the pandemic, that was a step change that's a positive change for e-commerce on a go-forward basis. The second thing is the creator economy is a $2.25 trillion marketplace. And we know that consumers, their number one go-to when they think about what they want is they're really looking for that personal expression of their authentic self. So that could be by buying a fabric or putting a pattern on wallpaper for your apartment, or it could be on the products we already provide. But it really is a trend towards personalization and self-expression.
I'm just excited because I know my producers will be happy to get wallpaper of my face on their walls as they do some redecorating in their houses. But I do want to ask, because Spoonflower, as I mentioned, helps users create those custom fabrics, that wallpaper, that gift wrap. What are some of the new goods that might be coming down the pike after this, essentially this merger between Spoonflower and Shutterfly?
Right. So just as a reminder, Shutterfly owns two consumer brands, Shutterfly and Snapfish, and home decor and gifting now represent about 30% of those businesses. And it's the fastest growing part of those businesses. So with this acquisition, we'll be able to add the products that Spoonflower has today for consumers who come to Shutterfly or to Snapfish. And then we really look forward to thinking about how do we expand that creator marketplace. Once again, with that focus of democratization, today the designs they focus on are repetitive designs you use in fabric or wallpaper. But really the world your oyster as you think about custom designs for wedding announcements or for baby showers or for all the gifts you may need to give for hostess presents all the way through to for your bridesmaids. And we really look forward to embracing the design of those creators as we think about refreshing what we offer on our consumer e-commerce experience.
Hillary, I'm curious to know, as we see some of these raw materials, the prices at least on the rise, how much inflation is a worry for the company?
You know, to date, we've been really solid in our experience with our suppliers. We have significant scale in the way we approach acquiring raw goods. And to date, we've been able to tamp down rising prices on the raw goods front. Always something we continue to evaluate. On the flip side, I would also mention that because we offer a custom product, often consumers are willing to pay a little bit more for that.
All right, we'll have to leave that there. Shutterfly CEO Hillary Schneider, thanks so much for joining us today. I want to talk now about a new platform called Tornado. It's a mobile and web-based investing platform that is hoping to help empower smarter investing decisions. We're joined now by Bernard George, co-founder and CEO of Tornado, as well as our very own Julia LaRoche. So, Bernard, you know, Robinhood recently went public. Curious to know how you would compare Tornado to a platform like that, and perhaps why is Tornado better?
Yeah, I think as a retail investor, I think the key question you have to ask yourself is, does your brokerage help you invest better? And I think for a lot of investors, unfortunately, the answer is no. Tornado is built from the ground up around that question, really about helping each investor take that next step in their individual path towards becoming a better investor.
You know, Bernard, it is a pretty crowded space when you think about these trading apps, and a lot of them are no fee. From what I understand, you all do charge a fee. What do folks get out of using Tornado and paying that fee versus, you know, the no fee options?
Yeah, we do charge a membership fee. And I think the key there is around incentive alignment. And I think as we've all learned over the past months and years, unfortunately, free trading isn't really free. It comes with a lot of conflicts. And a lot of these brokerages, which rely on payment for order flow, unfortunately have an incentive to direct users towards riskier penny stocks and options implicitly or explicitly. The brokerage model that we have with the subscription really does that align those incentives with our community.
Mm-hmm. And Tornado is not new. It was Investor. There was a recent rebranding here. You have been around since 2015. How has the growth been, and how have you started to see that accelerate maybe in the last year plus given the pandemic?
Yeah, we've seen a huge acceleration in growth and engagement. So far this year, we've seen a 68% increase in engagement rates in the platform. And a lot of that, I think, is really telling of the appetite out there for content and community that helps you sort of take that next step in your journey towards becoming a better investor.
And as part of that rebrand, $10 million seed round raised here with some big names, including the baseball star A-Rod, Mark Lori, who's super well known when it comes to e-commerce, and Dave Portnoy from Barstool Sports. What do you all plan to do with that $10 million? And talk to us about the partners that you all have brought on here.
Yeah, we're so thrilled to have Mark, Alex, and Dave involved as we scale the platform. I think the common thread that ties them together is a real passion for advancing financial wellness and investor education. And they all bring a unique angle to that. And we're so thrilled to have them involved. In terms of the use of proceeds, we'll be scaling the platform tremendously in terms of the community and really staying laser focused on our mission of helping our community and helping people take that next step in their journey towards becoming a better investor.
Mm-hmm. You keep mentioning education, financial education. Where do you see the gaps and the opportunities when it comes to kind of closing this gap, if you will?
Yeah, there's been kind of a crisis in investing education, unfortunately, recently. Every week there are headlines about young investors gambling on penny stocks and options and even bankrupt companies. And our view is that the only way to really solve that problem is to make smart investing highly engaging, so it becomes that path of least resistance for people.
Why do you think, you mentioned a crisis investor education. Why do you think that exists, or where do you think that came from? I would just be curious.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think what we've seen, I guess, in the last few years is a huge influx of first-time investors. And as a lot of new investors enter the market, obviously there's a need for education and, you know, the ability to take that next step. And democratization of access to markets has been a wonderful, amazing thing. It's just left a lot of people in that state where they're, you know, looking for that next step. And how do I continue my journey towards becoming a better investor?
So Bernard, I'm curious to know, you know, you keep mentioning that Tornado is going to help folks make smarter investing decisions. And I know that you're talking about financial literacy on the platform, investment tips. How does that interface, however, when someone's actually making an investment? Is there perhaps flagging if folks are selling too soon, that perhaps it's not the best decision to make, or that they might be on the hook for some higher taxes? You know, how does it work once investors actually start investing?
Yeah, there are really three ways we do it. Through community, through curated content and education, and through world-class analytical tools. In terms of the community, there's a really meaningful conversation with investors of all skill levels that really benefits everyone involved, and a whole range of content, including pros and cons that help people assess the risks and benefits of different investments, stocks and ETFs, personalized educational content, content from leading voices that helps people, you know, dive deeper, understand, you know, what's behind the scenes in a company and how to assess it as an investment, and also world-class analytical tools, including a portfolio optimizer, which helps people allocate their portfolio in a way that balances risk and reward for their individual situation, and also advanced performance and risk metrics, including things like Sharpe ratios and alpha and beta and portfolio volatility that you might not find in other platforms.
All right, we're going to leave that there. Bernard George, co-founder and CEO of the investment platform Tornado. Of course, Yahoo Finance's Julia LaRoche. Thank you both for joining us. Let's chat about heading back to school as districts and parents are trying to figure out how students can remain safe while getting an education in the classroom. We're joined now by Tony Thurman, California State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Tony, how are you right now ensuring that California schools will be safe and yet will still minimize the transmission of the coronavirus?
You know, people are optimistic about getting back to school. A number of our districts have already opened, and I would say that most are set to open in the next few days and weeks. I would say people are optimistic and cautious. We're following what's happening with the variant, but that we know that with a combination of vaccines, COVID testing and masking, that we can keep our students safe. And we know that they really need to have in-person instruction. And so we're working with our districts all across the state to help them get ready for a safe reopening of school.
And Tony, I was listening to some of your remarks and watching some of your interviews, and you know, you said that COVID testing is needed. And I remember you said, I'm going to quote you here, that you didn't think that we'd be able to make it without that COVID testing. Why is that, especially as we hear so many folks really pushing back against this need and the necessity for coronavirus testing?
To be honest, I'm just quoting what I've learned, like everyone else. You know, we've never done this before, and so we have to pay attention to whatever research and health data we have. And that data says that even someone with the vaccine can get COVID, especially due to the strength of this new Delta variant. And so we know that COVID testing is important. And also because there are so many young people who cannot be vaccinated, we know that right now we need to have the combination of mitigation measures. In our state, we've secured 5 million rapid COVID tests that we've made available to our schools for free. And so to me, that's really critical, because that means you can have awareness about someone being positive within 15 minutes. That allows that individual to quarantine safely while keeping the rest of the school community safe and open. And so it's just one of the many things that I think are important to helping us keep our schools open and keep our schools safe.
You know, it's interesting to hear you make some of these remarks. because not everyone around the country agrees with you, at least not all of your counterparts in other states. I'm, of course, thinking of Texas and Florida right now, particularly. What would you say to some of your counterparts in other parts of the country right now that are actively fighting school districts that are saying we are going to require that our students wear a mask if they are in the school, and we're going to do contact tracing, and we're going to want students that are in close contact with someone who is tested positive for the virus to stay at home? What would you say to them right now?
You know, I would ask those colleagues and others just to look at what the data tells us and what health experts nationally and locally are telling us, that the Delta variant has a different impact than COVID as we've known it before, and that children, especially those who are not vaccinated, are extremely susceptible, and that sadly, many children have experienced serious consequences, and even some have experienced death. You know, it is just at this point a fact that 99% of those who are experiencing the most severe consequences are those who are not vaccinated. And so I would just say, look, this is not about politics. And I would ask my colleagues and others to just think of these as life-saving measures. And to think about this, we all rejoice when things reopen and our schools are open, restaurants are open, we can spend time with our loved ones. Let's do the things that allow us to keep that. If we don't, then we can see as these cases continue to spike that we're going to be headed for all kinds of shutdowns all across the nation. No one wants that. I know it's an inconvenience to wear masks. You know, no one wants to think about COVID testing, but these are the things that we now know can keep us safe. And that we are in the business of educating, and now we have to be in the business of saving and protecting lives. And so I would encourage folks to think of it that way so that we can keep our students and their families and their educators safe.
And of course, you do at least have the backing of the California Governor Gavin Newsom for a lot of these requirements and mandates that the California school system plans to be implementing. That is not necessarily true, again, across the country, as we are seeing right now some school districts, frankly, being pitted up against the governors in their state. We've already heard of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis threatening to yank funding from school districts and also salaries of school board executives right now that are saying, listen, we're actually going to defy your order. We're going to try to protect our students the best way that we can. And we're going to require that our students wear masks in schools. What would you say to some of them? Would you advocate perhaps for some of these school district executives, these superintendents around the nation right now to perhaps defy the orders of their governors to help keep students safe?
Look, I'm not pulling punches here, but the Florida governor's comments to say don't use masks flies in the face of the wisdom that we've been provided by Dr. Fauci, by other health experts all across the state. And it is a scary proposition that children could be hurt, and in the worst case, that children could die. And so I applaud those school leaders who are pushing back and saying, we need to be able to use the only methods that we know that will keep our kids safe. Quite frankly, the threats to take away funding don't help anyone. We've seen this act before. President Trump did the same thing. Schools have a hard enough time figuring out how to do all this, keep people safe, and educate children. Threats to take away funding don't help the conversation at all. Instead, we need leadership. And you mentioned our governor. I'm grateful to our governor, who's really led an effort to help us get more vaccines. Californians have had at least one dose, more so than in any other state. We need to do more in this state and elsewhere. And tomorrow we're doing a statewide town hall encouraging more folks to get a vaccine. We'll have people like legendary Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the legendary Dolores Huerta, promoting the message about the importance of vaccines, because we still have time before school starts. We need the kind of leadership that takes those actions even when it's not convenient. Governor Newsom has done that. I would encourage those other governors across the country to think the same way. It literally could make the difference between life and death.
All right, we're going to have to leave that there. Tony Thurmond, California State Superintendent of Public Instruction, thanks so much for joining us today.